All right, welcome back to our Q&A time. And our first question is, when Luke 20 says nations will rise against nations and kingdoms against kingdoms, is Luke being redundant as a form of poetry, or could it be a deeper meaning for today's condition? A very good friend of mine did a sermon last week where he pointed out that the original word used for nation actually refers to ethnic groups. Yeah, I think that what Jesus is speaking about here is a progression from his time to the end of time, and that it would start out with tribal groups, the Germanic people and the Slavic people, or the Nordic people and the Saxons and the Normans, and these different groups will fight, and then they eventually form nation states, and eventually goes to like World War I and World War II, where the nation states are fighting against each other. So I think it was actually a difference that Christ intended, that it would not be nation to nation, but it was a progression of how civilization was going to advance. But there would still be war, just on larger scales as things advance. When you were answering the question about babies in heaven and sadness, you mentioned that people left here don't want to be with Jesus. Could you answer what it means when it says every knee will bow? Will the people recognize him, bow their knee, and then refuse to go with him? So my view of that, and I saw this question a little bit beforehand, is the same view as Ellen White wrote in Great Controversy, and this is on page 670. I'm just going to read what she wrote, but I agree with this perspective. This is at the end of time. It's after the 1,000 years, after New Jerusalem has come back, basically what some might call the Great White Throne Judgment period. Satan sees that his voluntary rebellion has unfitted him for heaven. He has trained his power to war against God. The purity, peace, and harmony of heaven would be to him supreme torture. His accusations against the mercy and justice of God are now silenced. The reproach which he has endeavored to cast upon Jehovah rests wholly upon himself. And now Satan bows down and confesses the justice of his sentence. Say, every question of truth and error in the long-standing controversy has now been made plain. The results of the rebellion, the fruits of setting aside the divine statutes, have been laid open to the view of all created intelligences. The working out of Satan's rule in contrast to the government of God has been presented to the whole universe. Satan's own works have condemned him. God's wisdom and justice and his goodness stand fully vindicated. It is seen that all his dealings in the great controversy have been conducted with respect to the eternal good of all of his people and the good of all the worlds that he has created. The history of sin will stand to all eternity as a witness that with the existence of God's laws bound up the happiness of all the beings he created. With all the facts of the great controversy in view, the whole universe, both loyal and rebellious, with one accord declare, just and true are thy ways, thou King of saints. Notwithstanding that Satan has been constrained to acknowledge God's justice and to bow to the supremacy of Christ, his character remains unchanged. The spirit of rebellion, like a mighty torrent, again bursts forth. Filled with frenzy, he determines not to yield the great controversy. The time has come for a last desperate struggle against the King of Heaven. He rushes into the midst of his subjects and endeavors to inspire them with his own fury and arouse them to instant battle. But of all the countless millions who he has allured into rebellion, there are none now to acknowledge his supremacy. His power is at an end. The wicked are filled with the same hatred of God that inspires Satan, but they see that their case is hopeless, that they cannot prevail against Jehovah. Their rage is kindled against Satan and those who have been his agents in deception, and with the fury of demons they turn upon them. So that's how I would answer that question. How does praying in tongues edify me? Why do devout Christians start out strong praying in tongues, but later in their journey stop doing it? 1 Corinthians 14:15, Paul mentions that he will pray with the Spirit and with understanding. Does that mean he interprets his own tongues and that this is what we should seek to do as well? No. So this is a lot of confusion that people get because of the way things are translated. Paul is talking about New Testament church where people have lots from different cultures and different languages. And if somebody comes, and let's say in my room here today, somebody stood up and wanted to say something, they hit something in Romanian or Russian or Chinese, it would not be edifying to us unless there was somebody here to translate that for the rest of us. So if you don't have a translator, then it's best to remain silent, not disrupt the meeting, because only when the noises being made speak truth truth or information can a person be edified. So the sounds of cymbals and gongs, he talks about people who make utterances that can't be understood are just sounding noises and they have no benefit for the church. So she remains silent. Talking about the Spirit, he's talking about sometimes, and we all had this in our personal journey, that you have something agonizing your soul, something that you can't even put into words. And you reach out in your heart to God. I don't know what's wrong, Lord. And you just kind of pour your emotional distress out to the Lord. That's what he's talking about, pouring it out in the Spirit. But he doesn't become edified until the Spirit enlightens him what's going on and what the truths are he needs to apply. And so that also is a private prayer matter. That's not something you do publicly. So that's what I believe is going on there. When Jesus is close to coming, Ellen White advises to move out of the cities. Why don't I see SDAs moving? Everyone seems happy and content in their present community. Even your class seems content. Does she mean just major metropolises? I would first say, do you remember Jesus walking on the beach with Peter? And Peter says, what about John? And Jesus said to Peter, it doesn't matter about John. Are you going to do what I've called you to do? So I would say to you first, if you feel convicted to move into the country, do so. It doesn't matter what people in my class are doing. You need to fulfill the purpose of God in your life. Now, looking to others before you go is a sure way not to be going the right way. So that's what I would say first. Secondly, I think each person would be convicted in their heart when God would have them move and go into the country. And I can't say when that would be for other people. I think some have done that, and some have been doing that in Adventism for 100 years, and the Lord still hasn't come yet. So each person has a different responsibility to figure that out for where God would have them go. You recently talked about babies who had died and that we would get to raise them in heaven for the righteous. The angels bring the babies. Okay. Do you have a belief about aborted babies that would they be in heaven? That would be most comforting to those who've had abortions. Thank you. No, I actually don't have a belief about that. I don't have any inspiration about that question. I don't know. And I think people are free to form their belief because I think the Bible doesn't give any indication about that question. Dr. Jennings, Jesus rebukes the apostles for contending to be the greatest, but he himself said that no prophet is greater than John the Baptist. What is your view on this? Is there a hierarchy and not everyone is equal, but then again, all gifts are from God, some are given more. Will it be unfair for those who are given less and produce less in return? So this is not about production or output, it's about quality of character. The one who was given one talent buried it and did not develop. Therefore, their character didn't develop. The one who was given five invested it and got five more. The one who was given 10 invested and got 10 more. So it wasn't about that they got 10 more or five more. It was about their character developed because they applied what God gave them and they grew and they expanded. So that's the principle involved here. Regarding John the Baptist, and of course you've quoted this correctly, that no prophet was greater than John the Baptist. That doesn't mean John was greater than them. Does it? No, it doesn't mean that. That's how we hear it, though, isn't it? Okay. But according to Jesus, the greatest in heaven will be the least. The first will be last, and the last will be first. The greatest will be the one that serves the most. And so what made John one of the greatest was that John, when they asked him, are you the Christ? No, I am not worthy to tie his shoes. John did not take power or seek power or seek to advance himself or seek a name for himself. So one, he was great in his humility. Two, he was the messenger to prepare the way for the Lord. So he had a great mission and called to do. Three, he shared in the Lord's suffering. And this is one of the things that inspiration tells us is one of the greatest honors a person can have. And the martyrs, if you remember in Revelation, have the little hem of red, and they're the closest to Christ in heaven, those who have given their lives for him. And so he was great not by the worldly standard of greatness, but great in love, great in humility, and great in self-sacrifice. And that's all our questions for today. So thank you all very much.